Hello, everybody. As I mentioned on the thing, or maybe this is the first one you're listening to because you don't give a shit about the thing. We are re-releasing two giant sci-fi franchises or movies. I guess they're both become franchises now. That both debuted the same date back in June of 1982. 40th anniversaries. They're getting creaky and old just like us, Jim. Mm-hmm. This is Blade Runner. Also commissioned by Sean Ray, as I mentioned on the Thing podcast. And like I mentioned on the Thing podcast, this is another classic example of why I like commissioned podcasts, because I had seen Blade Runner a couple of times. You know, I'm a science fiction nerd, and I always, you know, as we mentioned in the podcast, I always respected it for what it was and for what it meant at the time. But I found it like clunky and kind of plotting. And a whole bunch of stuff kind of didn't make sense, and some of the performances were flat. Sean recommending us watching the final cut, the director's cut, Ridley Scott's, like, it's very slight tweaks and nips and tucks here and there, but it just shows you what good editing can do to save a movie.
Oh, yeah.
Because
yeah, it's very good.
Oh, it fixes almost all my issues, even stuff that I was, like, long-standing... had antipathy for, like, the theory that Deckard himself was single-handedly changed my mind about Blade Runner and its place in science fiction. I think it's an amazing film, and I've enjoyed it several times since. I wouldn't recommend anyone watching a theatrical release.
Oh, no. Watch this one for sure.
This is just so, I mean, if you want to, just as a curiosity, but this is the definitive version according to the guy who created it and according to yours truly here. 40 years young Blade Runner is, and we talked about this film about 5 years ago. As I mentioned in the other podcast, some of the stuff deeper in our archive is harder to access, because our website's not the most friendly, and some of our feeds aren't that even that deep if you go back. So we're re-releasing it, spiffing it up for 40 years of celebration of Blade Runner and The Thing. They're both available right now, and they both came out way back in June 1982. I hope you guys enjoy the re-release of Blade Runner.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well, lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
Hey, everybody. We're back with another Bald Move Commission podcast. This commissioner was Sean Ray, who's commissioned a bunch of films in the past, and he's also dominating the last few commission podcasts we got here. I think we still got three left to do for him. He selected Blade Runner, which is a 1982 film, as you probably know, but he wanted us to see a particular cut, the final cut, which was released in 2007. This is the only director's cut that Ridley Scott actually worked on, supervised, and has endorsed as his definitive view of the movie. And this is one of the few versions of this film that I had not seen before. So I put it to you. This is, of course, directed by Ridley Scott, story by Philip K. Dick, starring Harrison Ford, Sean Young, Rutger Hauer, and Edward James Olmos. What did you think of this? You can talk about your history with Blade Runner. You can talk about your experience watching the film this time. Talk about whatever the hell you want. You're a professional podcaster.
So Blade Runner has been traditionally a weird movie for me, because I always, I guess, understood thematically why it got the respect it did, because it was wrestling with interesting questions and it had a really interesting aesthetic. And I thought that was kind of it, because when I had watched the movie before, it always felt messy to me. It always felt like this is a movie that didn't quite live up to the standards of its director or its creators. And watching the Final Cut movie for the version for the first time, I was blown away with how much better it is. It did not feel messy at all. It felt actually very tight.
Yeah, I talked to my Blade Runner 2047 or 2042. I can't remember what the new one is. That I've always had that kind of emotionally distant relationship with Blade Runner. A lot the same way I feel like when I watch like Ghost in the Shell. Mm. Like, I understand why this is respected for its time, and I see the DNA that it is provided to works come after that. But on the other hand, it looks dated, and there's a lot of jumbled, mixed up ideas. And I've always had that opinion of Blade Runner because, you know, it's like this goofy thing with a maybe stilted performance by Harrison Ford, and he's got these voiceovers that are just being phoned in, and the investigation's a bit hard to follow, but I've always admired the third act. Like, there's a lot of really good stuff in there.
Yeah.
This, number one, this is probably the best looking transfer I've ever seen of Blade Runner. And it really, like, I was kind of shocked to kind of watch this, not being distracted by like Harrison Ford's droning commentary. Mm-hmm. Just how well the world holds up. Like, it's extremely well designed. I do.
Yeah, the art direction on this is amazing.
Yes. And so many good ideas, so many inventive set pieces, mm-hmm. and so many big ideas. I do think that the world design is amazing, but I think the world building is a little bit sloppy.
But I think it's okay, because that's not the point of the movie, right? Like, there are a lot of logical questions that you have about the world that the movie foregoes because they're going for something bigger, right?
Well, as you well know, I'm a lore whore, and when I see mm-hmm. my daddy dom director get out the whips, the world building whips and chains, I get excited, and then he puts them back without barely playing with them, and I got all worked up for nothing, and so yeah, no, it's a big deal for me, but I'm just amazed at how a good it. I'm just amazed at what a good edit can do to a film. And I don't know why that surprises me, because I've seen, you know, it talked about everywhere from, like, you know, George Lucas's cut of Star Wars essentially being saved by an editor to mm-hmm. George Lucas saving key scenes in The Godfather for Coppola. Like, I truly believe it. Like, when you see such a night and day difference as a theatrical release of Blade Runner, mm-hmm. same movie buried in there.
Yeah.
But it's got a inappropriate ending tacked onto it. It's had a whole bunch of narrative and voiceover and stuff tacked onto it. It's just laboring to get out, and it struggles under its own weight. This movie, again, not perfect, but oh my God, I'm never watching another version of this movie again.
This is the definitive cut of Blade Runner in my mind.
The other thing is, like, I've been, and I know Sean Ray feels me on this, I've been a staunch proponent of the Deckard is not a replicant. Mm-hmm. I've been, you know, like, because that's my first exposure to the film. I think the theatrical release really puts its thumb on the scale to Deckard not being a replicant. This version, obviously, Ridley Scott believes he is. He really puts his thumb on the other side of the scale. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm just kind of, I'm okay with it. Like, I don't think it's, I think this film becomes like, you know, that optical illusion of like the vase, or it's two people kissing. Mm-hmm. And like, sometimes you can flip that as you're watching it, the picture can flip back, like, that whether Deckard is a replicant or not changes a lot of the themes and feel of the movie. And sometimes I can see myself flipping back and forth and seeing like, oh, well, this really changes his relationship with Sean Young if you think of it as him being a replicant, or, oh, if he's just a human, it kind of puts this flavor to it. Certainly changes the dynamics of the last fight with Rutger Hauer, Roy. I know this is something Sean wants us to talk about. Do you have an opinion on this, and how did this film change it? And do you agree with me that Deckard being a replicant makes or breaks the film?
Yeah. So I think my opinion going into this, I think it's been a while since I've seen Blade Runner, and it's hard for me to remember, but I think my opinion was that he was not a replicant. Coming out of this movie, I'm like, yeah, he's definitely a replicant. That origami unicorn with the added scene, which we assume is a memory of Deckard's, I think says it outright. It's not even implied. It's just yes, he is absolutely a replicant. And you know, you can argue about whether Ridley Scott goes too far in stating his own opinion, but honestly, like, where do you draw the line on saying, hey, the director has the ultimate final say in this thing, right? Because that's the thing, like,
right,
you can say, all right, well, the writer, because the writer and the director in this movie
disagree.
Argue.
Yes. Yeah,
they don't have the same opinion on Deckard and the nature of his being. So ultimately, in my opinion, it comes down to the director, because the director decides what makes it, has the final say on what makes it to the screen, and the movie and the narrative and the message of the movie is on his head. So Blade Runner, in my opinion, in the movie, the director's opinion is he is a replicant.
I agree with that. I do think the first half of the film is needlessly schizophrenic about that. Like, I kept on, as I was watching this version, I kept on thinking, why is the chief of police and this detective, creepy James almost figure, why are they so... I mean, like, if Harrison Ford is a replicant designed to hunt down Blade, or to hunt down replicants, as if he's a Blade Runner designed, why the fuck are they asking him permission? Why are they begging him to come out of retirement? Why are they? Now, every single time I started to wonder that, there was also a line about, well, you have no choice. But I'm like, why? Is that what makes Harrison Ford so good, that he thinks he's a human and he doesn't have any moral hangups about retiring these replicants? Why isn't it such an inefficient way to go about designing these robots that you have to fool them into thinking they're human so you can get their full potential out? And also, these sleaze bags, why would they go along with this system? It seems like, especially if you look at the new Blade Runner, you know, people don't think very highly of these replicants. Mm-hmm. Why would you bend over backwards to respect one of their feelings? Like, shouldn't there be more instances of these guys being wry, or, you know, like,
I mean, there is with, when it comes to, what's his name, Bryant, I think, Emmett Walsh.
Mm-hmm.
That guy treats the Blade Runners, and I thought during the thing that it, during the movie, that it was just simply a matter of, like, cops don't like the Blade Runners because they're doing their jobs and, like, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they view them as inferior. But if you look at it in the context of, like, Bryant knows that he's replicant and he's treating him that way because of that, instead, it kind of makes a little bit of sense, or at least they hint at that.
Yeah, and I think he tried, because, like, in film noir works, it's very stereotypical for the detective to have an adversary relationship with the cops, like you mentioned.
Yeah.
So I feel like, in an almost too cute way, Ridley Scott keeps on hopping on both of those kind of, like, viewpoints. Don't think maybe, like, the guys that he's having do it are up to the task of the subtlety and acting that would, like, I think that whoever Deckard's boss is, he could, I know he's a fairly well-regarded character actor, but I think he's very good. And I don't know whether it was, like, ADR because it was a noisy set, and because, like, I know, like, all of Harrison Ford's voiceovers in the theatrical version are the worst.
Yeah, they're bad.
Are the worst sort of Harrison Ford not giving a fuck or actively disagreeing with what he's having to do, or just like, I want to go make my cabinets. What the fuck? I whatever it is, but I feel like some of that is creeping into those guys' baseline performances, and it's not... It wasn't doing the job for me to really sell the whole, oh, this is interesting. Now that I see it, and I know he's a replicant, they're treating him like a robot with barely concealed contempt. But if he was just a private dick, they'd be treating him like that. So
they would. And I think that both, I don't know, in my mind, that is a good thing.
Yeah.
Because it kind of uses the tropes of the genre to mask
those
facts. And they're leaning into that. And I'm okay with that. And I think, you know, the first act being the question of, like, what is the difference between replicants and humans? And
yeah,
and that's a question that they answer in the third act to my satisfaction, which is, what does it matter?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, if you can't tell, what does it matter? And, you know, we've talked about this stuff at length in Westworld, this is kind of the grandfather of those. So I don't know. I think the first act, schizophrenia, as you called it, makes a certain amount of sense.
I think I feel myself being talked into it because, like, honestly, if I'm putting all my cards on the table, a lot of this hostility is left over
from the original
resentment or feeling like I was jerked around. Because I've always been very like anti Ridley Scott, not anti Ridley Scott. I'm pro Ridley Scott, but I also feel like whenever I heard him in an interview, like, he kind of fucked up and wishes he's kind of like, you know, in the same way George Lucas and Steven Spielberg have gone to fix their creations. Every time I've seen, like, because the other thing is, like, the first director's cut was just horseshit.
Yeah.
Like, it was labeled as a director cut and it felt very rushed and shitty and tacked on. It turns out that was released over Ridley Scott's dead body.
Yeah. And it was like a cash in on some limited theatrical release.
It absolutely was. And then they tried to do another fucking director's release and it felt like this has been a long time coming. But the thing that astounds me is that, and I don't know, this doesn't seem like it happens as much because we live in a much more transparent environment where directors have a lot more power to be like, oh, they fucked with my original vision.
Yeah.
But it's breathtaking how in the 70s and 80s and probably early, like, studios would just take a film from a director and fuck with it.
And then their career lived and died on that, right?
Yeah. Like, oh, well, we had a tepid audience, release from the audience, because we just pulled a bunch of people from some mid-America mall and forced them to watch a talky science fiction film. Like, they, and, you know, like, them, this movie is 1,000% better just chopping off the happy ending with Sean Young and Harrison Ford.
Absolutely.
Like, that like nervous paranoia of finding the aluminum unicorn and hearing the almost characters kind of voice echoing, and like that sense of paranoia and how they'll always be hunted now.
Yeah.
And him, like, rushing to the door and shutting it and the film goes black on that. So much fucking better.
So much better.
The film's already, like, a million times better, and then you strip off the wooden voiceovers and you cut it a little bit tighter. It's just so much better. So much better.
It's funny, too, because, like, the voiceover wasn't something Ridley Scott wanted, and those final... that final sequence with like the floaty camera through the clouds and the driving stuff wasn't even shot by under Ridley Scott's direction.
Right.
It was leftover footage from the Shining shoots.
No shit.
Stanley Kubrick's footage. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
His helicopter stuff. So
interesting.
Like that's such a weird fuck you kind of thing to do to a director who you hired to put in charge of the vision of this film.
Right.
And to take that out of his hands is crazy.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, if it happened now, it would be allowed in public debate, and people would demand to see the director's cut on Blu-ray, and people, we could, like, but now, but that's what I'm saying. Like, I remember thinking when I saw the differences, like, I don't even know if I, like, I've heard about, like, hey, it makes a huge difference to strip out Deckard's voiceover. I'm like, but doesn't that take away its film noir? Like, that's a film noir thing. Like, having the hard-boiled detective saying tough stuff over it. But it's so much better. It's so much better.
So much better. And I still got the feel of the noir, right?
Right.
Like the Texan noir stuff.
Right. Like
you don't need it.
It didn't need to be slavishly noir. It's just in its sensibility and the get-ups that they had in Sean Young and just the gritty, grimy, futuristic feel of the seedy underbelly of the city. That's what sold it on noir. And like, that's the thing. But I do feel that a little bit of like hackle of my old viewpoint raise and, you know. So, yeah, it's funny because I will say that the first time I watched Blade Runner, I really didn't enjoy the experience. It felt like I was going to school. Like, okay, this is an important film.
Yeah.
I see why it's important. I see why people watched this in the 80s and lost their shit. But, like, this has been replaced by superior works. Every single time I've watched it, I've liked it a little bit better. And now this version just takes the cake. So I cut off Sean here in the middle. He wanted us to watch the final cut, which released in 2007. He says, this is my favorite film of all time. Having said that, don't be afraid to criticize it. This is a science fiction neo-noir masterpiece that I can watch anytime and still be mesmerized. Ford gives a performance that is very different from his charismatic Han Solo or Indiana Jones, but I think it's perfect for a man whose job it is to hunt down synthetic humans. Production design of the Bradbury Apartments, Tyrell Corporation, Deckard's Apartments, the costumes, sets, lighting, music, and so on is unique and done in such elegance. There are moments I forget I'm watching a film. I'm utterly pulled into the world and Ridley Scott's depiction of future Los Angeles as a filthy, overpopulated, rain-soaked hellhole. But he shoots it so beautifully, becomes something else entirely. Sean has a lot of other thoughts and questions and even some thoughts on the sequel, but we will get that after we have our full review of the film.
I want to talk about all of the things that he mentions.
Yeah, so. Let's you want to start with Ford's performance?
Sure, I'll talk about like all of the characters and actors. I think he's right about Harrison Ford. It's a different performance, which is not something I'm used to seeing from... Although I would say this is... Yeah, this might be his most different performance, because I mean, even thinking back to like American Graffiti and stuff, he's still like that charismatic... kind of rogue sort of thing.
I mean, he's still Harrison Ford. Ford, by all account, is a deeply private weirdo. But when he goes out in public and smiles, people want to be his friend. Like, that's must be his curse. He hates everyone, but he's fucking Harrison Ford, so everyone wants to be him and have beers with him and have sex with him.
I feel like this Harrison Ford is the embodiment of the hero's journey, right? Like, he's so fucking reluctant to get into this whole thing. Like, he was a carpenter. He didn't really... He fucking built stuff with his
that
hands.
Just makes
he wasn't
him hotter.
Really that interested in getting into acting, that's but it that, kind of fell into his lap.
That humility is what makes him hotter, man. And I'm telling you what... Harrison Ford is fucking young. Is there a better looking man than young Harrison Ford? He is so smoking hot in this film. Like, and I realized
he's a good looking man for sure.
As I was realized that, like, I started realizing growing up with him in like Blade Runner and Indiana Jones and Star Wars. And he even was a, you know, in his later years, an action hero in his own right, and Air Force One and all the Jack Ryan shit. Like Harrison Ford, I kind of think is subconsciously my masculine physical ideal.
Okay. Yeah.
That I've tried to live up to. Now, made a sad mockery of it, obviously. I've taken that ideal and I have Sauron in Lord of the Rings twisted and corrupted it into this freakish mockery that I parade around as. But like, goddamn, Harrison Ford is, even when he's being kind of a prick, and he's a big asshole in most of this film, he's just extremely charming and handsome.
And he is maybe one of the biggest movie stars of all time.
Yes.
He has some of the most respected, beloved franchises under his belt.
Right.
And you know, he owes that largely to Lucas and Spielberg. But I think, like, low-key, he's maybe the biggest movie star on the planet.
I mean, that...
Because Tom Cruise has a lot of big ones, but they're not big like these are big. Like Harrison Ford is big. Indiana Jones is iconic. Harrison Ford as Han Solo is iconic.
Yeah, and
Deckard is iconic.
Yeah, exactly. He's, like, in the John Wayne, Paul Newman, Robert Redford. Like, he's already gotten into the pantheon where Tom Cruise still feels like he's trying to hustle. Because,
I mean, he's got
those
memorable characters. Like, Maverick is a good character, but, like...
Tom Cruise is not everyone's cup of tea.
For sure,
there is no cup in which Harrison Ford's tea would not be accepted.
That's probably true, yeah.
Like, Harrison Ford comes up to the bar and says, "Hey, buddy..." You're like, "You fucking asshole, get away from me." Nobody says that. There are
I don't
people,
want your Scientology bullshit,
there
Mr.
Are people
Ford. No, that doesn't happen.
That sprightly Tom Cruise pops up to them and starts talking about Dianetics.
Yeah.
You know,
and they put a cover on
Mike Ehrmantraut would belly up to the bar with Harrison Ford.
For sure.
Because he is Harrison. Yeah, I mean, so he's just, his appeal is universal. Like, it's so easy to want to be him, to imagine to be him, to imagine you're with him. Like, He's kind of like, I don't know, he's a little Keanu Reeves like that. He's such a enigma that you can kind of hang whatever kind of ideals or psychopathy that you want on him.
Yeah.
That said, what did you make of the scene? Because this is the thing when I watched it right before the sequel that I'd totally forgotten.
Oh, God, I know
this,
what scene you're going to talk about.
The scene where he has... a sexually charged encounter with Sean. He turns her no into a yes is the only way I can describe it. That's a really uncomfortable scene, and I've always looked at it from the view of Deckard as a human, knowing that she's a robot, knowing that she's previously been kind of like this deluded slave, and it feels very sadistic. Watching him thinking that he too is a replicant and might be cottoning to that idea, like, it seems like it's an acting out of his own lack of free will and choice.
Yeah.
Like, this is us, this is that. But I'm not saying, obviously, it makes it all right. It just completely transformed my gut reaction to that scene from, like, well, just this is, he's just using her like a fucking sex toy and she has no agency at all, to neither of them have agency. He might be forced 30 minutes from now to hunt her down and kill her, and he won't be able to say no. Uh-huh. But maybe he can't. I mean, what do you think?
I don't know. I mean, the thing that I was feeling during this scene is, I think that 1982 is telling me this is sexy. 2018 is telling me this is very much not.
Right.
And I was torn between, like, is this supposed to be a sexy, seductive scene of a man taking charge and a woman who does actually, you know, want this relationship? Or is this supposed to be a very scary moment? And I couldn't help but come down on the scary side.
Well, yeah, no. And that's the thing, is like, there's a difference. Like, I imagine there would be a lot of people that would fantasize about being in that situation because of the danger and because it is scary and because he is so powerful. And that's fine for as far as fantasies goes, some kind of consensual relationship. But just physically blocking a woman from leaving your apartment, yeah, and, you know, kissing her, and then when she pulls away, physically restraining her and kissing her again and making her say this is okay. I mean, that's fucking dark shit.
It is.
Yeah.
And I think that was just the 80s.
So you don't think that Ridley Scott, because that's what I was trying to think, is like, maybe Ridley Scott was making a point about their essential bondage to the system because he deeply believed it was this guy was a robot that knew he's a robot and knew she's a robot. I don't know.
It could be, because even if you want to say, well, there is no fundamental difference between robots and humans,
right,
I could see that affecting the psyche of somebody who thinks that they're a human, finding out that they're a robot, or even considering that option, and that being a very much scary thing to them, and them acting out in inappropriate ways. And this would certainly be that.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think it's possible.
By the way, the fact that we're debating what this meant in 1982 and whether it was sexy or not, hashtag rape culture, just saying.
I do not condone what happens on the screen.
Right, right.
But in 1982, what was going through the heads of the people making this movie?
Yeah, right. Okay, what else about Harrison Ford?
I don't know that I have much more.
I will say this. This is something other that I think he does with Keanu Reeves, is Keanu Reeves is like an average guy's level of like, yeah, I'm a best day. Maybe I could pull that off. Like, you know, when I was 20, I was in my mid 20s, I could have got with Sandra Bullock and stopped that bus, or I could have jacked in with Morpheus and that. Harrison Ford, when he's escaping from Roy,
climbing that building,
he does such a great, like, he's not Nathan Drake in it.
No,
he's not just like bounding up at 10. Like, he is like peak average man physical ability, jacked with adrenaline, with his fingers broken, and he's just barely making it. And somehow that is so, it's kind of like Jason Bourne driving around in a Volkswagen Rabbit. It's way more exciting than if he had like a Dodge Charger or whatever,
for sure.
Like, it's the performance envelope that makes it exciting, because he's just barely doing it.
Yeah.
But yet you could also imagine, like, maybe that's part of the fantasy. It's like, it's not Arnold Schwarzenegger just ripping a dude in half. He's just trying to survive and trying to get to the next minute of his life. It's him and Roy are in, I mean, that's what makes that scene work. It's Roy about to die and losing control of his body, but being obviously physically superior, with Deckard perhaps more human.
Like, let me ask you about that. The physicality of Harrison Ford in this movie, doesn't it sort of betray that maybe the writer did not think it was,
that's what I'm saying,
that he was a replicant?
That's the other, like, not only is it like, I don't think they nailed the balance between his human handlers, like the ball busting or maybe just android racism, I don't think they nailed that right. That's the other thing, like Deckard's physical performance, and like, what if you made someone to hunt down Blade Runners, why the fuck would you make them inferior to the most combat capable version you have?
Right.
Maybe it's because you're afraid to lose track of them. And then it's like, you know, it's like that, a Simpsons problem. Like, you've got your overrun by rats, so you get snakes, and then finally you get a...
If you give a mouse a cookie,
a rare meat-eating gorilla from the mountains of Africa, and they just freeze to death in the winter. Like, what do you do to stop the Blade Runner who's the hulking out, you know?
Yeah.
But I thought the same thing. Like, the other thing... This is my larger issue, the world building. Like, when someone tells me that these are indistinguishable from humans, and then they dip their fingers in molten lava or super cool, and there's no, like, fuck me, you can tell. There's no way that's made out of the same fucking material. Do you know how I know? Because if I stuck my hand in there that is indistinguishable from humanity, it would combust or it'd freeze. Uh-huh. Like, don't fucking tell me you can't put this guy into an X-ray machine and tell that he's not a fucking replicant.
Right.
Come on now.
For sure, the construction of them is much different than humans.
It's the Battlestar Galactica thing. Like, we have no way to distinguish these from normal humans, but somehow they're able to beam themselves through subspace, so...
No, I think the movie came up with the worst possible way for the replicants to prove how badass they are, and also to, like, show that they're replicants and they're not humans, because... Right. Yeah, they try and walk that line of, like, these are so close to humans that humans can't tell, and also the line of they're superpowered humans who can do anything.
Yeah.
It does start to stretch the bounds of credibility, and I think actually Westworld kind of works better in that regard.
Absolutely. I was about to say the same thing.
Yeah. And now, with the exception of that core in their heads, that would be super easy to detect. But but everything else about, like, their body and their physical makeup works better than this movie.
Yeah. Like, if the replicants were peak human ability, like, and I'm talking peak, like, full of adrenaline, you know, that would still be a terrifying opponent to have. Yeah. Someone that could go full, or someone that can ignore pain or what would be like, or shock. So they can, you know, non-fatal, but otherwise devastating, incapacitating, injured, they could ignore, but they can't just, and that's the thing. Like, you could have essentially the same scenes of, like, Ray traipsing naked through a freezer because he's not in danger of freezing, but he's able to just ignore the fact that, you know, he's cold.
Yeah.
I just felt like that was another part where they didn't really think through the world building. But then again, the state of the art for that shit has moved along. I mean, there's been a bunch more android secret identity type movies, so they've perfected it. But I just thought that some of that stuff is lazy in throughout the film.
Let me use the cloak of talking more about this idea of Deckard being or not being a replicant to talk about how creepy Edward James almost is in this movie.
And his
fucking eyes and that mustache. The mustache, the facial hair, the Fu Manchu or whatever he's got going on.
Is he doing like a yellow face? I felt like there's a little bit of Big Trouble Little China. Like, he'd be cackling in a store about some kind of ancient sect of electrical warriors.
Now that you say that, you might be right about that. I didn't get that.
Right. Which, maybe. You know, it's the 80s. He's trying to work. A lot of people, you know, this isn't Short Circuit. I'm not wanting to crucify a guy, but I felt like it's a little creepy Asian mystic stereotype.
It was very vague, though. So
he's going to sell me a Mogwai in the second act.
Right. Well, they had that guy in there, too, if you really want to go there.
True. Yeah. Like, maybe that's the thing. Like, we can't hire two wizened Asian old dudes. Let's make up James. Yeah. It's like, get this guy.
But what they did with his eyes was super creepy. Those contacts, those all, like,
like
whitish blue.
He's almost unrecognizable.
Yeah. It's freaky.
So, yeah, kudos for looking like a creepy, decrepit dude. And, you know, it's like, I also thought, like, maybe he's a Blade Runner, too. Like, he's a retired one.
Yeah. So I think in the movie, he is a Blade Runner, which to me raises the question, why do they have a Blade Runner looking after a Blade Runner if that Blade Runner is not a replicant? Right. Like, I almost thought Edward James Olmos' character is there to keep Deckard on track. Keep him from, like, discovering that he's a replicant until he finally tells him that he's a replicant at the end.
Are Blade Runners paired with either? So I'm prepared to accept that the Olmos character is a replicant.
Okay.
Do you think he's a human?
Maybe he's a replicant that wanted to tell the other replicant that he is a replicant.
Ooh.
Like, he's a
resistant part of it. Because, like, you know, by the second movie, there's a whole resistance underground of these guys built around the religion of Deckard and Rachel.
So maybe, I don't know. They never quite go into it far enough for me to say.
Right. But it's another one of those things where it's kind of interesting, and like him being creepy as either like a severely wounded first generation human version of a Blade Runner, or, mm-hmm. you know, as just a creepy constructed one. Like it works. It works.
A few other characters I want to talk about.
Right.
Daryl Hannah. I always, whenever I saw Cameron Howe from Halt and Catch Fire, mm-hmm. I always related her to this character because they look somewhat similar.
Sure.
But Daryl Hannah plays this Pris character as seductively intimidating
mm-hmm.
and also very creepy, right? Like there's something in the performance that says this is a very disturbed replicant.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it comes down to simply the costuming, when she's got, you know, the black stripe across her eyes and
right.
pale white body paint, but yeah, I don't know. Something came across as very creepy, and I think the performance is a big part of that.
I love her doing when she puts the black stripe on her eyes. Like, mm-hmm. that's so fucking iconic and so cool.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's supposed to be a pleasure droid. I think that's one of the things they're playing with is you've made these, they say, same way in Westworld, you've made these superior beings mm-hmm. that are capable of flights of fancy and emotion. And then you have them do the worst jobs. It's not like, oh, I feel sexy, I'm going to be a sex worker, I'm going to be a sex worker. But no, she was made to do that.
Yeah.
And Roy is made to be a combat drone, and Fuckface McGee, whatever the guy who overacted about mothers, is made to be like a construction, like, you know, menial, and like he's even given a menial mind for it, which that also was kind of a sloppy piece of world building. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's just the horror of being a thinking of a creature and know that like there's no way out. Like you're not going to graduate from this. You're going to, and then you find out that you've got a pre-programmed 6-year lifespan. Mm-hmm. You've got memories that were designed to control you and essentially impart basic programming to you, but they're not your own. I mean, that's the thing. Like, a lot of this shit's understated. Like, yeah. You have to watch the movie multiple times to appreciate all the pathos of the villains. The first time, they're almost, like, slightly more urbane and witty Terminators.
Absolutely, yeah.
But you have to really think about it. You identify with them more and more as you watch it. They become much more sympathetic.
Absolutely, and especially the Rachel character. Like, I was looking at her character throughout this film, And just the idea that when she goes to Deckard and she says, "You think I'm a replicant, don't you?" Just that core. And I know this applies to some areas of people's lives, but it doesn't typically apply to like the core of what they are. To be ashamed, you know, to have society telling you that you should be ashamed of what you are at your very core, your very, very physical makeup.
Right.
In this case, you know, you're a replicant. You're not a human. Humans never have to struggle with that idea of being a human might be a bad thing.
Right.
Whereas replicants do in this universe. So I felt a very powerful sort of sadness in that regard.
Yeah, you know, that's why these are great morality plays, because it's essentially anytime you've got a thing that by all intents and purposes presents as human, but you're denying the humanity of, you know, then you're it's a hop, skip and a jump to talking about, you know, race relations, you know, sexual mores and orientations and like all that kind of stuff, because we have these things that were undeniably human, but we're treating them as less than because why again?
And we're as humans given the privilege of never having to question whether being a human is a good or bad thing.
Right. Yeah. Like if you're born the default, you never have to wrestle with us or something wrong with me.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the other thing is like, in my experience, the human existence is asking the question, what's wrong with me? I can't even imagine what it's like if society is adding on to that, just the thing that's fucking with everybody, the whole idea that society as a whole kind of thinks, you're not all there. You're not right. Like it's gotta be terrible
for sure. And so I powerfully felt, the plight of Rachel's character. And I guess by extension, all of the replicants.
Why was Rachel made? I mean, that's the thing is
a good question.
Is Tyrell, Because, like, the guy right below Tyrell is played by, you know, Daryl, whatever.
Sebastian.
Yeah, his name. Sebastian. Yeah. He just seems like he is either simple-minded or he's so, like, set apart from his own time because he's got that Methuselah disease that he just doesn't, I don't know, like, he just seems like he's very childlike. He doesn't, and in fact, I thought it was a really interesting point to give him this disease because it's something that allows him to empathize with the synths. And the other thing is, I always thought that their relationship was more menacing in this version of the film, and kind of like in my frame I was watching it, I felt like he wasn't really afraid of Roy or Pris until Roy just smacked
crushed
Tyrell.
The head. Yeah.
Right.
I think you're right. Yeah.
And before, like, I had always thought, like, when Roy and Pris were kind of being a little menacing towards him, that he was scared, and I didn't get that this time, or at least not as much.
Yeah. No, I feel you. I thought the same, and I was surprised not to see it.
And I also thought, like, that the other thing is that I thought Roy and Pris were kind of okay with him. Like, there's one point when I think things could have gone wrong because he was essentially not going to live up to, you know, kind of like if it's like, well, you say you're, you know, you have affinity for us and you don't have a problem with our love, but you're not going to help us. Like, they just kind of essentially made him feel bad about his default, you know, like, save his own ass presentation. But it didn't feel particularly menacing. I don't know.
No, not nearly as much as I remembered it feeling.
Right. Which I don't know if that's editing or if that I don't know if it's just like, like I said, the difference in experience in the film this way was shocking. I'm still coming to grips to it.
I want to talk about one other character before we get to what I view as, like, the main show, talking about Rutger Hauer. It's 1982. This movie is made along with a lot of other movies featuring little people. And I, Hollywood in this era, I think, was obsessed with casting little people as, like, weird creatures.
This era?
I don't think it happens nearly as much anymore.
No, I'm talking about, like, go back to the dawn.
That's what I mean. Essentially before CG.
Yeah, right.
They would cast, and I don't know if it's out of necessity or whether it's some kind of disrespect, but, like, I just couldn't shake the feeling, like, oh, you need a weird clown monster. Oh, cast a little person. And you need, like, a group of essentially Jawas salvaging parts off of Deckard's car. Call in the little people. Like, it felt a little weird and gross.
I wonder how little, like, if I was a little person, how, because, like, man, that's a complicated thing, because
you want work.
Like, for example, right now it's very in the social conscious that if a straight person, a straight cis actor tries to play a trans character, they're like, you know, that there are, like, lots of trans men and women trying to get jobs in Hollywood, and they're not, and they perhaps can't play a conventional part, so you're taking these from them too. But, like, you know, I imagine, like, you know, like Dobby from Harry Potter. It's a weird little dude. He's entirely CGI. That took a job from somebody, though. Like, yeah. I wonder if there is a little bit, like, yeah, these aren't great jobs, and maybe I get tired of playing gnomes and gremlins and whatnot, but I was working and now I'm not. Now there's no place for me.
No, there's Warwick Davis actually does a TV show.
Right.
Fuck, I can't think of the name of it. It's with Ricky Gervais.
Yeah. I know what you're talking about. I can't remember either.
I've watched the whole thing, and it's actually really good. It's an interesting commentary on being a little person in society, and specifically in Hollywood, and kind of what that means to him, and how, I guess, he reconciles those issues. It's a comedy, so...
Yeah.
You know, it has the potential to offend, but Warwick Davis is very, I guess, involved in those kinds of issues.
Right.
And then that show's good. And finally, I want to talk about Rutger Hauer. Roy Batty character is another iconic one, you know, as much as Deckard in this movie is iconic. Rutger Hauer probably makes this movie for me.
Yeah.
There's an intensity and an intimidating factor to his performance, but also you become deeply sympathetic by the end of the movie for his character.
You can't discount the physicality of his performance too, because he does look like like if someone said that he's playing Apollo in some kind of Greek thing, you'd be totally believe it. He's very fine featured. He's got beautiful gold hair. He's got a fantastic body. He looks like somebody. He looks like something that's physically perfect, right?
Yeah, the visual of him running down that hall, like skipping down the hall in his underwear, was a very like, I don't even know how to describe it. It's not quite otherworldly, but it does have this weird off-kilter feeling to it that says I'm something other than human, and it's just the way he moves, I guess, that really sells it.
I totally agree with that assessment. There is something about it. Roy's character in this third act reminds me of a character out of like a Julie Taymor production. Like, she's the director of The Lion King. She's also done like Titus and a bunch of, but she's known for like stuff that is freaky and fluid and beautiful, I guess, or very arresting and gothic's not the right word, but and him running through and with the spike through his hand and the like Priss's blood on war paint, like there is something extremely primal. Mm-hmm. Like he could be a monster running through a dark ages forest in Europe, or he could be running through this abandoned building in LA. It's the same kind of archetypal primal Frankenstein type of character. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure, you know, that's a great way to compare like performances for things, like, you know, try to pretend like, you know, who could you cast that would embody that exact same thing. And with him, with like a lot of the main characters here, I think a lot of people could have done what Sean Young did, because she just had to look beautiful and porcelain and perfect. I don't think a lot of people could have done this things that like Daryl Hannah did, Rutger Hauer did, and Harrison Ford did in this movie.
Yeah, and in my mind, it makes the tone of the third act.
Yes,
because I need to be truly terrified of this man, but I also need to be sympathetic to his ultimate plight. And both the plot, the directing, the cinematography, and most importantly, the acting in those scenes really carry it for me.
Right.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk Podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
I will say that, like, this show has so many big ideas. Like, there's a guy designing eyeballs in like a frozen tank room, and he's like that never leaves, so he's just wearing this like warming suit. And like there's other you know, scandals about like underground organ stuff, and I'm like, I kept thinking, because this is all set in like 2018 2016, I'm like, I kind of feel like I'm ripped off, because our future is way dumber and more boring.
That's like in my, like, I gotta look at my notes.
I think of like the political scandals of fucking Blade Runner, where you're talking about artificial humans being sent off planet to work in mines and fight robot wars
and the interstellar gates and like all sorts of shit.
And like illegal cloned eyeball trades and stuff. Uh-huh. And we've got this stupid shit. This is the stupid shit that we fight about.
No, it's totally overestimated the ambition of humanity.
Fuck,
right?
Yes they did.
Like, they're talking about, like you said, all the off-world colonies, and then like we're here like getting people, seeing if we can get our 19th century people movers to drive themselves,
right?
And like and talking online with each other,
right?
Arguing about stupid shit, like what's the best version of Blade Runner, for instance.
What's better, or like even like stuff like, you know, how people should be allowed to live their fucking lives, like yeah, no, bring on, let someone invent AI. Let's kick this into high gear. I'm so fucking tired of like you said, debating 19th century shit. I want like maybe a dystopia to at least like at least can it be cool? Can I look outside and be like, hey, you know what? From a certain, it's a hellscape. This Cincinnati is a hellscape I'm living in, but it's visually interesting to look at.
Well, yeah, I mean, I do want to talk about how they really nailed just LA in 2018.
Right. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
LA is a hellhole. Right. They nailed
it's
that.
It's just going to get smoggier.
Uh huh.
It's just going to get, yeah.
At some point, the trend reverses and it gets rainier.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know. As the ice caps go into the sky or something, that sounds right.
Yeah.
the other thing that they really fucking get wrong, well, several things, but one of the things I want to talk about is miniaturization, because they don't, and like UI developments in general, because they don't do flat panels.
Right.
Everything is these fucking analog knobs and buttons, and they just fucking whiffed on the idea that everything is going to get smaller and faster and sleeker. Mm-hmm. And they just went with chunky. They went with like the Star Wars aesthetic.
Yeah, it's funny because Sean cites as one of his favorite scenes, Deckard's enhanced scene. And like that just plays to me as almost parody at this point. Like this guy just, first of all, I don't think the investigation is very good or compelling. It's like he finds a thing that might be a fish scale, but no, it's a lizard scale. And he goes to the lizard guy and he just shakes him by the collar. And that guy tells him to go here. And then that guy leans on him. It's like, I didn't feel smart at any time. And like that enhanced scene, like I'm, that must have blown people away. The idea that like you could do this forensic investigation just by looking at a photo, like it's so, but like NCIS and all that other shit has just ruined it and made it into a parody. So like a 15-minute slow scene of Harrison Ford saying pan left 90 degrees, stop, midline focus,
it's very slow. Yeah,
it's like, oh my God, I fucking get it. So,
and like, I could see a way where that technology could work in the future. Like, if you have extremely high resolution captures
that you're running all the time because you've got infinite storage, apparently.
Okay. Or, I mean, even just taking a photo, like, what if it was not like 4K or 8K? What if it was 600 million K?
Right.
Then maybe you could get to like the enhance where it can zoom way in and be pixel accurate and still viewable.
And you can navigate around objects, because that's the other thing. Is like,
at some point,
like,
he does like shift.
Because I know you can do that with like, there's certain cameras that can like parallax and stuff and allow you to move around in different dimensions. But
it takes like multiple cameras and that kind of thing.
But like, I did like, so there's some futurology that doesn't work in this movie, some world building that doesn't. And like, you contrast that to like the Matrix, where like you can't really accuse it of miniaturization because they got fantastic shit, they got mundane shit, and they kind of mix it all together in kind of like a magical alchemy. Mm-hmm. I will say the one part of the world building I really liked is like the Voight Kampff test.
Like, okay, yeah.
Like that, if you do have an artificial being that you can't tell the difference, but like there are, like you can find cracks in like exploits in their embedded memories or whatever. I thought that was super cool.
Yeah. And I guess the way I read it is they're looking for the emotional cues that humans produce that the replicants can't reproduce.
Right. Yeah.
Is that
right? Like they're trying to provoke an inappropriate emotional reaction or a emotional reaction that doesn't match up with the physiology.
Right.
And like, you know, that's why they tell it that Rachel's impressive, because usually you can tell 20 to 30 questions. It took over 100. Even Decker then was, I think, pretty sure.
Yeah.
Probably because her eyes glowed orange. That's a dead giveaway.
That doesn't help. Although Edward James Olmos, who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Did your you notice? Because I thought the last version of this film I watched, there was a scene where Harrison Ford's eyes briefly glowed. And I looked for it in this one, but I was also taking notes sometime, and I didn't see it because I thought I was kind of outraged when I saw that, because I'm like, well, that's just giving the ghost away, because like every single other replicant we met in the series, their eyes flashed that gold color, which I thought was super cool.
Like that shot of the owl is really striking.
Yes.
And the shot of Rachel where it's like in the background, you can see lights coming in the windows.
Yeah.
And it's kind of drowning the screen in white for a little bit. Yeah, there's a lot of beautiful filmmaking, too. The other couple of things I thought were silly in retrospect, Atari being like a major brand and TDK and like these huge like parts of the city being designed after like Atari logos and shit.
I mean, you're not wrong that we are essentially ran by mega corporations. You just,
it's not Atari.
Yeah. They weren't the survival of the fittest.
No. And then finally, the one in my mind that's the most glaring, obvious flaw in the futurology of this movie is smoking.
Yes.
Everyone is smoking indoors in LA.
People smoke.
Right.
What the fuck?
But people really don't smoke. Like, smoking is not going to be a thing. Like, maybe vaping will be a thing.
Right.
But smoking is dead, as far as I can tell, in America.
Smoking will become, like, some kind of hipster thing where you roll your own tobacco and it won't have... Sure.
Won't be a populist thing.
No. I do think... Although, I don't know, because, like... I've said that before on certain societal trends, and like, you know how to get the young people to rebel? Tell them that something's not cool. Like, you know, that the adults don't think something's cool.
Yeah, that's why everybody's vaping.
And dangerous.
Their mom and dad hate it.
I feel like vaping's not anywhere where it was in the last 2 or 3 years either. Like, I used to see people blowing clouds all the time, but I don't know. Maybe they're like, we figured it out and people are just taking it to the smoke stuff that the smoke places I don't see anymore.
But I find it hard in modern day to find people who are smoking.
Yeah, no,
you
totally
have to seek them out. Whereas in this, it's depicted as just being everywhere.
Right. I really liked the shot where Deckard gets his first kill against an android, which is where he kills the snake dancer. I really thought it was arresting her death sequence, because like it was a very dehumanized, like, you know, a lot of times you see a person get shot and they're like, you know, they fall down and they're dead. Here they filmed her like she's a deer in the woods. sprinting from the hunter. She gets shot. She's like scrambling to her feet, trying to make it. And by like turning, like I felt like by filming this in a very dehumanized way, where she was just like a wounded animal, terrified, trying to get away, it actually weirdly humanized her. Mm-hmm. Like anytime you see people being dehumanized, it like moves you to like the empathy. And I thought that was interesting. The same thing with like when Pris shot, she reminded me of like a bug that'd been sprayed by spray, and like it was so weird, and like
it was super weird. Yeah,
it was like just that fucking crazy performance, and to the point where it like it believably rattled, like Harrison Ford gave performance like that was rattling him, you know. Mm-hmm. Of course, that by that time that was like the third replicant he'd killed, and like do you think Deckard knows that he's a replicant by the end of the movie?
Yeah,
I do too.
I think that's what that nod is.
If you buy the interpretation, which I think I'm coming around to, then yeah, and I think he kind of cottons onto it somewhere between the death of Pris and the death of Roy.
Yeah, I think so.
So, but yeah, I thought that was really cool.
It is confirmation.
I thought the toy house fight was super cool. Like Pris hiding amongst all those weird robot toys. Mm-hmm. And Deckard kind of sneaking around trying to find her, and you know, when she starts twisting his head, like I believe that she could tear his head off.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what you're supposed to believe, is like even though Deckard doesn't know he's superhuman, that like a normal human she would have ripped his head off, and she couldn't his. I don't know.
Could be. Yeah.
I love when he finally gets down to fighting Roy. And like Roy does that as a cool scene where he grabs his gun through the wall and breaks his fingers, and then he starts howling.
Uh-huh.
That's like him stripping down naked and chasing Deckard through this abandoned building, howling at the top of his lungs, is so fucking freaky and such a good use of this character.
Yeah.
It's so damn gothic and Shakespearean. I love it. I love everything. I love everything about from the moment Deckard gets to Sebastian's floor and starts going through the toy house. Like this movie is damn near flawless from that point on.
Yeah, I agree.
Then there's also like, it's so funny because we just played Heavy Rain, the Robot Edition.
Right.
Detroit Rock City becoming. Uh-huh. There is a scene that is a complete homage to Blade Runner where they go into the pigeon apartment. There's that ruined apartment. There's just pigeons and pigeon shit everywhere. There's like, that's almost, I think, exactly laid out the same as that scene where Roy gets his pigeon that he adopts.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But no, I thought that was cool. And then, you know, what do you say about the final soliloquy that they give Rutger Hauer here?
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of lines that I enjoyed. But yeah, the tears and rain, that soliloquy, is that you're talking about?
Well, even before that, there's this thing about it's quite an experience to live in fear. That's what it's like to live as a slave, which I think is what you're supposed to... I almost wish that was the voiceover you heard before Deckard flees from the apartment, because that would really, really set the mood. But that's like that's kind of like the watchword that all of these robots that rebelled at once kind of have, that like, you know, living in fear is living as a slave, and even if they were to extend their life, that would still they'd still have to be living under fear and living under being hunted.
Yeah, for sure. That's a great one.
But yeah, tears and rain. Let's talk. Go, man, go.
Yeah, I mean, it's a story of the last of his kind dying.
Right.
Right. I mean, at least in his mind.
Right.
Because you know, earlier he tells Pris like we're the last two.
Right.
She gets killed. He logically assumes I'm the last one.
Right.
It's. I don't know. I guess it should be sadder than it is, because I look at that and I go, well, you're not actually the last one, right? I think there are actually two more left. And then if you add on Blade Runner 2049, we know that these things are going, don't have a limited lifespan anymore, and also are going to reproduce. So
I got a more of a melancholy from a death of an individual. And there's like, cause we just did an Empire business where I talked about, Terry Gross's interview with Maurice Sendak, the author of Where the Wild Things Are, and that's one of the things he hit in that interview, because he was close to death and he doesn't believe in an afterlife, and he's talking about like just being kind of general sad that like all these beautiful life experience and these friendships and relationships will become what when you die? Nothing. Like the like Rick Roy's saying that I've lived this incredible life that's like you know, you could write like novels about, and they're all these incredible things I've seen. And I love how they're just non-specific, but cool. So like attack right. ships burning off the shoulder of Orion. That's, I feel like I've seen that book cover. I've seen that painting without having actually seen it, and sea beams glittering and the whatever. Just like, yeah, these are like, that's also a commentary about like, you know, all wars in human history have been fought by humanity. And like, so you always have like, you can never shake a communal sense of like the horror of war or the glory of war or whatever, mm-hmm. like an idea of like all fighting being done by these synthetic humans. Like, it's almost like, what if there was no pictures of Vietnam, you mm-hmm. know, or like starting 50 years ago, there was no more war pictures because it's just robots and nobody cared. It's just like this, you know, it's like. It's a little bit of that too, like that yeah. kind of, you know, how are you going to learn from history if it's all being erased? That was a fucking good speech.
It is. Yeah.
Good dialogue.
The capper to the film is very good. There's one that is equally good, though 1,000 times cheesier. It's when Leon says, "Wake up, time to die."
Yeah.
It's just like the, that's, I don't know. It's ultimate 80s cheese, in my opinion. I know it's meant to have a bigger meaning, right. I think. It's meant to have a bigger meaning.
Because Rutger calls it back when it's time for him to die.
Yeah. But in my mind, it was just hilarious.
But yeah, the whole, like, that's the whole tension that the, in that final scene, Roy slowly breaking, the superior specimen slowly breaking down at the end of his life, Deckard. It's a race. Like, can I kill you before I die? Mm-hmm. And then at the, as he's about to cross the finish line, Roy concedes the fight. I think that's, and I'm not prepared to say what I think that means. And I know that Sean wants us to talk about it, but I honestly, I don't know. I don't know whether at the end, when he starts talking about his experiences and being, erased in the rain, and maybe the only thing I can figure is that he realizes that Deckard is a replicant and he's like a brother. And that, you know, whoever gets extinguished, it's going to be the loss of something special and unique.
Yeah.
And distinctive.
I think that's important. More so than him being a replicant or not. It's probably Roy acknowledging that killing you is doing a disservice to the universe.
Yeah.
In a weird way.
And maybe my cause, too. Like, if I, if I just pursue single-minded vengeance against my oppressors, then I'm an easily dismissed villain. But if I have, like, this final act of magnanimity, then maybe not. I don't know, because that's also...
And if I let you live, there's someone, something of me that lives on through you.
Right.
Like, now you've seen, you know, the Batak ships burning off Orion right. in me.
Right.
Maybe? I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. The flame that burns twice as bright burns half as long.
Mm-hmm. And you've burned so very, very bright.
Really. So, maybe the voiceover... Because I thought this final scene was when he finds a unicorn origami. Maybe the voiceover is about living in fear, living a slave. Because that's what I got in my notes. But yeah, just again, there's also, because, like, you know, there's a whole bunch of points you can debate about whether he's a man or not. And like the his handler saying, "You've done a man's job, sir." Like, that's in retrospect pretty heavy handed, too. Yeah, that's the thing. Like, there's no one piece of evidence like is the smoking gun, except for what you said is the unicorn, although. Man, the metallic unicorn at that, because like I was trying to, as the scene was unfolding, I was trying to think like, well, I guess it could be a coincidence. This guy made a chicken at the first, and it doesn't mean that Harrison Ford secretly is a chicken. So like he just makes weird animals and he does origami stuff. And this is just a coincidence, like, you know, but it doesn't feel like it, especially when they made it out of metal.
Well, I think it's I read somewhere in some article that it's the, like, the top of a cigarette pack, like the little foil.
Oh yeah. No, thing. I'm not saying he like literally made, but I'm just saying that like the fact that it's shiny metal is some symbolic of something artificial or synthetic.
Gotcha.
In a way that paper isn't, because paper grows on trees.
Yeah. I thought you meant like literally a human couldn't fold that.
No, okay. No human can make aluminum foil folds that precise. They're all robots, all the way down.
Stainless steel.
In fact, there's only one human in the whole film, and it's Tyrell, and it killed him. Mm-hmm. Everybody else is replicants. They don't know it. They don't know their people.
All right, I think that's about all I got.
All right, Sean passed along two pieces of trivia to us. One, Steven Spielberg was in post-production on Raiders of the Lost Ark and sent the demo reel of Harrison Ford's best takes to Ridley Scott when he heard Scott was interested in casting him for the lead role. In fact, Deckard was supposed to wear a fedora throughout the film, adding a layer to the noir look, but that was scrapped once Ford was cast due to his fedora prominently featured in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah. It does seem weird that a man in a city as rainy as future LA would not wear a hat.
Yeah, I mean...
Although I gotta say, the collar work in this movie is impeccable.
The collar work, yeah.
The collar work. I mean, look at Rachel's collar. It's fucking absurd. Harrison Ford has his, you know, trench coat with the collar popped. It's... But yeah, no hat.
It's like Miller and Expands. It keeps the rain off your head, kid.
It sure does.
Sean asked some questions. Why does Betty save Deckard's life? I don't know. Maybe so he has a witness to deliver that badass soliloquy as he dies. I think we talked about that. That is very... like. That's why I hate talking about it, because I feel like that's something everyone should get to interpret for themselves.
Mm, yeah.
Like, it can be a discussion, but like, it is... It is the part of the film, I think, that's most up for debate, because, you know, if Roy was trying to be like a martyr for a cause, why crush Tyrell's head if he was like, you know, it's like it's weird to think that he would reevaluate human beauty and frailty right after he smashed his creator's head. I don't know.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's also easy to see where he could, you know, have a nihilist sort of viewpoint at that moment, right? Like, I'm dying, my creator is dead.
Everyone's dying,
Like, what am I going to do here? And just kind of give up on this mission to kill Deckard.
Sean also has an observation. I enjoy the role reversal show between the replicants and the humans. Deckard does not show many emotions throughout the film, as opposed to replicants, who I feel show a wide range of emotions. What did you think of the Voight-Kampff test used to detect replicants?
Yeah, we kind of mentioned that.
Yeah, we did. I wrote down the different questions. Yeah, the tortoise question. It's funny because, like, it's your birthday. You're given calfskin gloves. And, like, Sean Young immediately said, oh, I wouldn't accept. In fact, I'd turn them into the police. I'm like, all right, robot right here. This can't possibly be the right answer that's not robot.
Right.
Like, what the fuck? All of our other questions, like the I'm watching a television, a wasp lands my arm, kill it. All right, fine. It's interesting because it's so weird and random that like I buy it instantly as, okay, this is a personality. And in much the same way that the Gosling role had the interconnected, except like they had that like verbal test that tasted as best baseline. Remember that?
Yeah, I vaguely remember that.
Like, it's like, okay, that feels like a baseline test for a robot. Like, what the hell would that look like? We don't know. So making it weird and having a little lie detector mixed in with it, I thought was, is great. It's a great piece of future-proof tech.
Yeah.
Because this only works on this particular line of Nexus robots. So if we create robots in the future and their personality tests look nothing like it, then fuck you, because they're not Nexus 6.
Yeah.
There's been arguments over the years whether Deckard himself is a replicant, an argument even a star and a director have had. Sean chooses to believe he's not one.
Okay.
The two biggest reasons are the movie's main theme is man versus machine, and the final chase is a personification of this theme. It weakens the whole movie, in my opinion, if it's just two machines fighting.
Does it still weaken it if Roy thinks he's fighting a human?
I guess not. Also, like, why, to me, like, I agree with you. I kind of agree with you, obviously, Sean, because up until like the last 72 hours, I've been a diehard Deckard's not a replicant person. But I also think that maybe this is just 2018 Aaron speaking, but like, I don't like portrayals that show humans winning over superior artificial intelligence anymore. Like, I just don't buy it. Like, I feel like there's a lot of room to make interesting, cool stories about that. But like, once we get to the Skynet phase, I think we're fucked. And there's not all the John, you can have a million John Connors in the world, but that's like having a million fucking army ants against one guy with a match and a can of gas. Like, it's just not gonna fucking matter, man. We got, like, if we get to Skynet, we already done fucked up and we're probably off to the dustbin in history. So like, once we invent a super smart, super strong, super soldier, Like, it's just going to be Spartacus, except for that's going to be the slave revolt that ends things for all time, I think.
And I think this movie does well to kind of cordon off the replicants, mostly to the outer planets and other systems and stuff like that. Off-world, as they call it.
Yeah.
Because here you've only got, four to six of these things to even deal with. Right. So that's a much more manageable thing.
But, like, on the other hand, they're way off world and they're in these lightly supervised colonies. Like, what if they take one over, manufacture a bunch of starships and attack ships and send them flaming off the shoulder of Earth, you know? Like,
it didn't seem to me that they had superior intelligence, I guess.
You didn't think so? Because they mentioned...
No, because they, you know, Roy goes into that room with Tyrell and he's asking questions, like... I don't have the answer here, and if I did have the answer, why would I be coming to you?
But he had a whole bunch of like advanced knowledge of like genetics and engineering and all that, and,
but so
and,
did Tyrell,
and the, what's what I'm saying, but the opening more credits so even. Made it explicitly stated that these robots were at least, if not more, intelligent than their genetic designers. So
sure.
I also think that if I'm Roy, I'm not buying this old man's like one sentence dismissals of my scientific theories.
Sure.
Well, what if I invert the tachyon beam? Oh, well, we thought about that and it just wouldn't work. Trust me, your testicle hair turns blue.
The deflector shield would go up in flames.
Yeah, like he's like every single time it's like motherfucker, look, okay, well, let's see the PowerPoint. I want to see the test results. I'm calling your bluff.
I want to see the math.
I'm calling your bluff and I'm cracking your head like a walnut. Maybe that's why I did.
He knew he was getting bullshit.
I mean, obviously, if a guy's not going to help you or doesn't know how to help you, then like, why not crack their head like a walnut?
Sure, that's my philosophy.
The only reason I don't crack everyone's head like a walnut, there's something I might need from them. The other line of evidence that Sean enjoys is that he's not a replicant in a novel. Do androids dream of electric sheep? Now, that is a pretty weak card to play, I think, because when you adapt something from another work, one of the chief joys of that is giving it a little twist and having Deckard be like, you know, the fact that he's not a robot in the source material, like, I don't know. That seems like more of a premise that you did then have to like build evidence to support than something that's just like a, you know, boom, Philip K. Dick didn't mean him to be an android. So
yeah, I mean, frankly, I think once it turns into Blade Runner, it's out of his hands.
Yeah.
It's now in Ridley Scott's hands.
Yeah.
And Scott seems to think, yes, he is.
So we both think at this point, we're recent converts to the Deckard's a replicant, at least in the Blade Runner film. And although I do think it's valid and interesting to interpret the other way and see how it changes the film. Mm-hmm. It's a fun little optical illusion, I think. He also had a brief discussion about Blade Runner 2049. I feel like Fancher and Green's script was as good as the original. When I read a synopsis of uncovering a secret that could destroy the world, I got a bad feeling in my gut. But Blade Runner is a small story about hunting replicants. I felt they found a good way of walking the tightrope, of expanding the Blade Runner mythos, raising the stakes, but still keeping it grounded in a way I felt the protagonists were capable of overcoming the obstacles of the story. Half of me wants the sequel to complete a trilogy for this new franchise. Half of me says, why mess with perfection? But if there's a third Blade Runner, you can bet I'll be there to commission it to hear your thoughts on it. Maybe. We'll see.
So I don't have quite the same rosy view of 2049 as Sean seems to. I
really liked it. I remember really liking it, and I remember you not liking it as much.
Well, I think that's another movie that suffers because of the edit. Like, it needs a much tighter edit. I was bored to tears in some scenes by things that I already knew, and the audience in general already knew, and they just kept drawing out the reveal on it. Drawing it out. There's a 15-minute scene of Ryan Gosling walking through a fucking factory looking for some totem, and I'm like, I know what the fucking totem is, and I know that it's here. Just show it to me. That is a movie in desperate need of another edit, and I think it would be a really tight, really excellent movie if you did that.
I think you're right about the length of the film. I'm not sure I would agree with your cuts to that particular scene.
I hated that scene.
Because I know, and we have a complete opposite feelings about it. Because, like, it's which end of the camera the tension was on, but... I liked it more than you. I haven't seen it recently, so I wouldn't be able to say that. I am kind of interested in seeing it again now that I've seen this excellent version of Blade Runner, like to see if it holds together more. But, you know, I don't know, because I remember thinking, I wasn't all that invested in the Harrison Ford, Sean Young, Robo Baby plot. Like, to me,
I mean, that,
like,
is the movie, right?
It is the movie, yeah. But I also thought that, like, Ryan Gosling's character, like his similar voyage of self-discovery, yeah, and whatnot was... Because, like, you know, if you say that the original Blade Runner is about a human that finds out he's a replicant and then escapes into the forest to breed, then this is the Blade Runner 2049 is a story about a replicant who knows he's a replicant that then realizes throughout the movie that he is actually a human, mm-hmm, that he's human in all the ways it's important.
Right. That, what does it matter?
That he's been lied to by Robin Wright his whole life. So I think that is also really interesting and a valid way to approach the material. So I liked it as bookends. Yeah, I agree. You can knock off 10, 15 minutes of that movie, not miss much. I'd probably knock different minutes off. But, I mean, that's a becoming a growing criticism of a lot of Hollywood and TV. Like, I'm glad the golden age of cinema and television are allowing people to make movies of arbitrary length, but I think some people abuse that.
Yeah, I don't want it to get self-indulgent.
Yeah, like I've seen a lot of hour and a half episodes of television that did not feel like they justified the extra 15 minutes I got. I definitely felt that way about 2 hour and 30 minute movies, 2 hour and 45 minute movies. But then again, you know, like there's movies like The Godfather that's exactly as long as it needs to be.
Yeah,
and I feel like we have reached that with this review. It's exactly as long as it needs to be. It's starting to feel a little flabby, so let's cut it here. Sean Ray, thank you again for commissioning this film. Honestly, this is one of the very few times where watching something for a commission has transformed my opinion of it.
Yeah,
like I had thought, like, you know, again, I saw Blade Runner, I'm not sure which release, but it wasn't this one, right before Blade Runner 2049, and I still thought it was kind of a chore to get through. This really transformed my experience, so thank you for that. We'll be back with another commission podcast, Laura 1944, back before we get back to Sean Ray as we consider The Thing, another 1982 classic.
Oh man, I can't wait for that one. I can't wait.
Until then, I'm Aaron
and I'm Jim.
Later.